The Selected Shorts podcast is sponsored by Audible.com, home to over 75,000 audiobooks and more, including the Thalia Book Club and Selected Shorts series. Learn how to download a free audiobook at audible.com/symphonyspace.
From PRI, Public Radio International.
You start building your private New York the first time you lay eyes on it. Maybe you were in a cab leaving the airport when the skyline first roused itself into view. All your worldly possessions were in the trunk, and in your hand you held an address on a piece of paper. Look, there's the Empire State Building.
Alec Baldwin, reading from Colson Whitehead's essay, Lost and Found, which we will hear later on this edition of Selected Shorts, a series that originates in live performance on stage at Symphony Space in New York City. I'm Isaiah Sheffer. The theme of the four fictions we hear on this program is Lost and Found, the rediscovery of something thought to be irrevocably gone. We'll hear first a story by Etgar Keret, the remarkable young Israeli filmmaker and writer. Etgar's wild imagination is reflected in this story read by our friend Leonard Nimoy. Good Intentions is about a professional hitman, an assassin who discovers he still has what he thought he had gotten rid of years ago.
There was a thick envelope waiting in my mailbox. I opened it and counted the dough. It was all there. So was the note with the name of the mark, a passport picture, and the place where I could find him. I cursed. Don't know why. I'm a pro, and a pro isn't supposed to do that. But it just came out. No, I didn't have to read the name. I recognized the guy in the picture. Grace. Patrick Grace. Nobel Peace Prize laureate. A good man. The only good man I'd ever known. When it came to good men, there was probably nobody in the world could match him. I'd only met Patrick Grace once. It was at the orphanage in Atlanta. Like animals, they treated us there. All year long, we wallowed in filth. They hardly fed us. And if anyone so much as opened his mouth, they would let us have it with a belt. Lots of times they give you the belt without bothering to open the buckle. When Grace arrived, they made sure to get us cleaned up. Us in that hole they called an orphanage. Before he came in, the director gave us a briefing. Anyone who blabbered would be in for it later. And we'd all had our share of his medicine, enough to know he meant business. When Grace entered our rooms, we were silent as mice. He tried talking with us, but we didn't really answer. Each boy got his present, said thank you, and hurried back into bed. I got a dartboard. When I said thank you, he reached for my face. I cringed. I thought he was going to hit me. Grace ran his hand over my hair, gently, and without a word, he lifted my shirt. In those days, I used to shoot off my mouth. A lot. Grace could figure that out by the look of my back. He didn't say anything at first, and then he said the name of Jesus a few times, and finally he let go of my shirt, and he hugged me. And while he was hugging me, he promised that nobody would ever hit me again. Needless to say, I didn't believe him. People don't just act nice to you for no good reason. I figured it had to be some kind of a trick. He'd be slipping off his belt any minute and letting me have it. The whole time he was hugging me, I just wanted him to go. He went. And that same evening, we got a new director and a whole new staff. From that time on, nobody ever hit me again. Except that I wiped out in Jacksonville. I did that one pro bono. Since then, nobody has lifted a finger on me. I never saw Patrick Grace again, but I read about him in the papers a lot, but all the people he'd helped, all the good things he did, he was a good man. I guess there was no finer man anywhere. The only man I owed a favor on the whole face of this ugly planet. And in 2 hours, I'm supposed to be meeting him. In 2 hours, I'm supposed to be putting a bullet through his head. I'm 31. I've had 29 contracts since I got started. 26 of them I completed in one go. I never try to understand the people I kill. I never try to understand why. Business is business, and like I said, I'm a pro. I've got a good reputation, and in a profession like mine, a good reputation is all that counts. You don't exactly place an ad in the paper or offer special rates to people with the right credit card. The only thing that keeps you in business is that people know they can count on you to get the job done. That's why I've made it a policy never to back out on a contract. Anyone who checks my record will find nothing but satisfied customers. Satisfied customers and stiffs. I rented a room facing the street right opposite the cafe. I told the owner that the rest of my belongings would be arriving on Monday. I paid 2 months' rent up front. There was half an hour to kill till the time I figured he'd get there. I assembled the gun. I zeroed in on the infrared sight. Only 26 minutes left. I lit a cigarette. I was trying not to think about anything. Finished the cigarette and flicked what was left of it into the corner of the room. Who'd want to kill a person like that? Only an animal or a complete wacko. I know Grace. He hugged me when I was just a kid. But business is business. Once you let your feelings in, you're through. The carpet in the corner began to smolder. I got up off the bed, and I stepped on the butt. Another 18 minutes. Another 18 minutes, and it would be over. I tried thinking about football, about Dan Marino, about a hooker on 42nd Street who gives me head in the front seat of the car. I tried not to think about anything. He was right on time. I recognized him from behind by that special bouncy walk of his and the shoulder-length hair. He took a seat at one of the tables outside in the best-lit spot so that he was facing me head-on. The angle was perfect, medium range. I could take this shot blindfolded. The red dot showed on the side of his head, a little too far to the left. I corrected to the right till it was dead center, and I held my breath. And just when I had it all set, an old man wandered by carrying all his earthly possessions in a couple of bags, a typical homeless. The city's full of them. Right outside the cafe, one of the handles snapped. The bag fell to the ground, and all his junk started spilling out. I saw Grace's body stiffen for a second with a kind of a spasm at the corner of his mouth, and right away, he got up to help. He kneeled down on the sidewalk, gathering up the newspapers and the empty cans and putting them back in the bag. The sight stayed fixed on him. His face was mine now. The red spot of the sight was floating on the middle of his forehead like a fluorescent Indian caste mark. That face was mine. And when he smiled at the old man, it glowed like the paintings of the saints on church walls. I stopped looking through the sights, and I took a good look at my finger. It was hovering over the trigger guard, straight out, almost frozen. It wasn't going to go through with it. No point of fooling myself. It simply wasn't going to. I thumbed on the safety. I eased back the bolt. the bullet slid from the chamber. I headed down toward the cafe with my gun in its case. It wasn't a gun anymore, really, just five harmless parts. I sat down at Grace's table facing him and ordered a coffee. He recognized me at once. Last time he saw me, I was an 11-year-old kid, but he had no trouble remembering. He even remembered my name. I put the envelope with the money on the table, and I told him that someone had hired me to kill him. I tried to play it cool, to pretend like I'd never even considered going through with it. Grace smiled and said that he knew that he was the one who'd sent the money in the envelope, and he wanted to die. I got to admit his answer caught me off guard. I stammered. I asked, why? Did he have some malignant disease? Like a disease, he laughed. Well, I guess you could say that. There was that little spasm again at the corner of his mouth, the one I'd seen through the window, and he started to talk. Ever since I was a kid, I've had this disease. The symptoms were clear, but nobody ever tried treating it. I'd give my toys to the other kids. I never lied. I never stole. I was never even tempted to hit back in school fights. I was always sure to turn the other cheek. My compulsive good-heartedness just got worse over the years. But nobody was willing to do anything about it. If, say, I'd been compulsively bad, they'd have taken me to a shrink or something right away. They'd have tried to stop it. But when you're good, nah, it suits people in our society to keep getting what they need in return for a shriek of delight and a few compliments. And I just kept getting worse. It's reached the point where I can't even eat without stopping after every bite to find someone who's hungrier to finish my meal. And at night, I can't fall asleep. How can a person even consider sleeping when you live in New York and 60 feet away from your house, people are shivering on a park bench? The spasm was back at the corner of his mouth, and his whole body shook. I can't go on this way with no sleep, no food, no love. Who has time for love when there's so much misery around? It's a nightmare. Try to see it from my point of view. I never asked to be this way. It's like a Dybbuk, except that instead of a Dybbuk, your body is possessed by an angel. Damn it! If it were a devil, someone would have tried to finish me off a long time ago. But this... Grace gave a short sigh, closed his eyes. Listen, he went on. All this money, take it. Go find yourself a position on some balcony or rooftop and get it over with. I can't do it on my own, after all. And it gets harder every day, even just sending you the money, having this conversation. He mopped his forehead. It's very hard. It's very hard on me. I'm not sure I'll have what it takes to do it again. Please, just pick a spot up on one of the rooftops and do it. I'm begging you. I looked at him, at his tormented face, like Jesus on the cross, just like Jesus. I didn't say anything. I didn't know what to say. I'm always armed with the right sentence, whether it's for the father confessor, for a hooker in a bar, or for a federal agent. But with him, I was a scared little kid again at the orphanage, cringing at every unexpected move. And he was a good man. The good man. I'd never be able to waste him. No point even trying. My finger just wouldn't wrap itself around the trigger. I'm sorry, Mr. Grace, I whispered after a long while. I just... You just can't kill me, he smiled. That's okay. You're not the first, you know. Two other guys have returned the envelope before you. I guess it's part of the curse. It's just that you, with the orphanage and all, he shrugged, and me getting weaker every day, somehow I hoped you could return the favor. I'm sorry, Mr. Grace, I whispered. I had tears in my eyes. I wish I could. Don't feel bad, he said. I understand. No harm done. Leave it. He chuckled when he saw me pick up the tab. Coffee's on me, I insist. It has to be on me, you know. It's a disease. I pushed the crumpled bill back in my pocket. Then I thanked him, and I walked away. And after I'd taken a few steps, he called me. I'd forgotten the gun. I went back to get it, cussing quietly to myself, feeling like a rookie. 3 days later, in Dallas, I shot some senator. It was a tricky one. From 200 yards away, half of you, sidewind. He was dead before he hit the floor.
Good Intentions by Edgar Carret, read by Leonard Nimoy. Though our next piece, whose title is Lost and Found, is Colson Whitehead's meditation on walking through the streets of New York City and realizing what used to be over there and how so many of the things one remembers are now vanished, we think the experience will resonate with residents of the other 150 cities who are listening to selected shorts on the radio. This piece is from Whitehead's book, The Colossus of New York. His newest book is a novel, Sag Harbor. Reading Lost and Found is that multiple threat friend of symphony space, the TV comedy star, Broadway and film actor, and New York Philharmonic and Oscar host, who still finds time when he can to read a short story for us, Alec Baldwin.
I'm here because I was born here, and thus ruined for anywhere else. But I don't know about you. Maybe you're from here too, and sooner or later, it will come out that we used to live a block away from each other and didn't even know it. Or maybe you moved here a couple of years ago for a job. Maybe you came here for school. Maybe you saw the brochure. The city has spent a considerable amount of time and money putting the brochure together, what with all the movies, TV shows, and songs, the whole if-you-can-make-it-there business. The city also puts a lot of effort into making your hometown look really drab and tiny, just in case you were wondering why it's such a drag to go back sometimes. No matter how long you have been here, you are a New Yorker. The first time you say, that used to be Muncie's, or that used to be the TikTok Lounge, that before the internet cafe plugged itself in, you got your shoes resold in the mom-and-pop operation that used to be there. You are a New Yorker when what was there before is more real and solid than what is here now. You start building your private New York the first time you lay eyes on it. Maybe you were in a cab leaving the airport when the skyline first roused itself into view. All your worldly possessions were in the trunk, and in your hand you held an address on a piece of paper. Look, there's the Empire State Building. Over there are the Twin Towers. Somewhere in that fantastic, glorious mess was the address on the piece of paper, your first home here. Maybe your parents dragged you here for a vacation when you were a kid and towed you up and down the gigantic avenues to shop for Christmas gifts. The only skyscrapers visible from your carriage were the legs of adults. But you got to know the ground pretty well and started to wonder why some sidewalks sparkle at certain angles. Maybe you came to visit your old buddy, the one who moved here last summer. And there was some mix-up as to where you were supposed to meet. You stepped out of Penn Station into the dizzying hustle of 8th Avenue and fainted. Freeze it there. That instant is the first brick in your city. I started building my New York on the Uptown No. 1 train. My first city memory is of looking out of a subway window as the train erupted from the tunnel on the way to 125th Street and palsied up onto the elevated tracks. It's the early 70s, so everything is filthy. Which means everything is still filthy because that is my city and I'm sticking to it. I still call it the Pan Am building, not out of affectation, but because that's what it is. For that new transplant from Des Moines, who was starting her first week of work at a Park Avenue South insurance firm, that colossus squatting over Grand Central, is the MetLife building, and for her it always will be. She is wrong, of course. When I look up there, I clearly see the gigantic letters spelling out Pan Am. Don't I? And of course, I am wrong in the eyes of the old-timers who maintain the myth that there was a time before Pan Am. History books and public television documentaries are always trying to tell you all sorts of facts about New York. That Canal Street used to be a canal, that Bryant Park used to be a reservoir. It's all hokum. I've been to Canal Street, and the only time I ever saw a river flow through it was during the last water main explosion. Never listen to what people tell you about old New York, because if you didn't witness it, it's not part of your New York and might as well be Jersey. Although that bit about the Dutch buying Manhattan for 24 bucks might have something to it, there are and always will be braggarts who got in at the right time. There are 8 million naked cities in this naked city. They dispute and disagree. The New York City you live in is not my New York City. How could it be? This place multiplies when you're not looking. You move over here. We move over there. Over a lifetime, that adds up to a lot of neighborhoods, the motley construction material of your jerry-built metropolis. Your favorite newsstands, restaurants, movie theaters, subway stations, and barber shops are replaced by your next neighborhood's favorites. It gets to be quite a sum. Before you know it, you have your own personal skyline. Go back to your old haunts and your old neighborhoods, and what do you find? They remain and have disappeared. The greasy spoon, the deli, the dry cleaner you scouted out when you first arrived and tried to make those new streets yours, they are gone. But look past the windows of the travel agency that replaced your pizza parlor, beyond the desks and computers and promo posters for tropical adventures. You can still see Neapolitan slices cooling, the pizza cutter lying next to half a pie, the map of Sicily on the wall. It is all still there, I assure you. The man who just paid for a trip to Jamaica sees none of that, sees his romantic getaway, his family vacation, what this little shop on this little street has granted him. The disappeared pizza parlor is still here because you are here. And when the beauty parlor replaces the travel agency, the gentleman will still have his vacation, and that lady will have her manicure. You swallow hard when you discover that the old coffee shop is now a chain pharmacy, that the place where you first kissed so-and-so was now a discount electronics retailer, that where you bought this very jacket is now rubble behind a blue plywood fence and a future office building. Damage has been done to your city. You say, it happened overnight. But of course it didn't. Your pizza parlor, his shoeshine stand, her hat store, when they were here, we neglected them. For all you know, the place closed down moments after the last time you walked out the door. 10 months ago, 6 years, 15, you can't remember, can you? And there have been 5 stores in that spot before the travel agency, 5 different neighborhoods coming and going between then and now, other people's other cities, over 15, 25, 100 neighborhoods, thousands of people passing that storefront every day, each one haunting the streets of his or her own New York, not one of them seeing the same thing. We can never make proper goodbyes. It was your last ride in a Checker cab, and you had no warning. It was the last time you were going to have Lake Tung Ting shrimp in that entirely suspect Chinese restaurant. And you had no idea. If you had known, perhaps you would have stepped behind the counter and shaken everyone's hand, pulled out the disposable camera, and issued posing instructions, but you had no idea. There are unheralded tipping points, a certain number of times that we will unlock the front door of an apartment. At some point, you were closer to the last time than you were to the first time, and you didn't even know it. You didn't know that each time you passed the threshold, you were saying goodbye. I never got a chance to say goodbye to the Twin Towers. And they never got a chance to say goodbye to me. I think they would have liked to. I refuse to believe in their indifference. You say you know these streets pretty well. The city knows you better than any living person because it has seen you when you are alone. It saw you stealing yourself for the job interview, slowly walking home after the last date, tripping over non-existent impediments on the sidewalk. It saw you wince when the single frigid drop fell from the air conditioner 12 stories up and zapped you. It saw the bewilderment on your face as you stepped out of the stolen matinee, incredulous that there was still daylight after such a long movie. It saw you half running up the street after you got the keys to your first apartment. It saw all that, remembers, too. Consider what your old apartments would say if they got together to swap stories. They could piece together the starts and finishes of your relationships, complain about your wardrobe and musical tastes, gossip about who you are after midnight. 7J says, "So that's what happened to Lucy. I knew it would never work out." You picked up yoga, you put down yoga. You tried various cures. You tried on selves and got rid of them. And this makes your old rooms wistful. Why must things change? 3R says, "Saxophone," you say. "I knew him when he played the guitar." Cherish your old apartments and pause for a moment when you pass them. Pay tribute, for they are the caretakers of your reinventions. Our streets are calendars containing who we were and who we will be next. We see ourselves in this city every day when we walk down the sidewalk and catch our reflections in store windows. Seek ourselves in this city each time we reminisce about what was there 5, 10, 40 years ago, because all our old places are proof that we were here. One day the city we built will be gone, and when it goes, we go. When the buildings fall, we topple too. Maybe we become New Yorkers the day we realize that New York will go on without us. To put off the inevitable, we try to fix the city in place. Remember it as it was, doing to the city what we would never allow to be done to ourselves. The kid on the uptown number one train, the new arrival stepping out of Grand Central, the jerk at the intersection who doesn't know east from west, those people don't exist anymore. Ceased to be a couple of apartments ago. And we wouldn't have it any other way. New York City does not hold our former selves against us. Perhaps we can extend the same courtesy. The Twin Towers still stand because we saw them, moved in and out of their long shadows, were lucky enough to know them for a time. They are a part of the city we carry around. It is hard to imagine that something will take their place, but at this very moment, the people with the right credentials are considering how to fill the crater. The cement trucks will roll up and spin their bellies, the jackhammers will rattle, and after a while, the postcards of the new skyline will be available for purchase. Naturally, we will cast a wary eye toward those new kids on the block. But let's be patient and not judge too quickly. We were new here, too, once. Thank you.
Alec Baldwin read Lost and Found by Colson Whitehead. After a brief time out, we'll hear stories by Jamaica Kincaid and Charles Johnson. You're listening to selected shorts recorded live in performance at Symphony Space in New York City and at other venues nationwide. From PRI, Public Radio International. Welcome back to Selected Shorts. A mother-daughter tale is our next story on the theme of what is lost and what is found. From Jamaica Kincaid's collection, At the Bottom of the River, comes this poignant memoir entitled My Mother. The reader is Laureen Towler.
Immediately on wishing my mother dead and seeing the pain it caused her, I was sorry. And cried so many tears that all the earth around me was drenched. Standing before my mother, I begged her forgiveness, and I begged so earnestly that she took pity on me, kissing my face and placing my head on her bosom to rest. Placing her arms around me, she drew my head closer and closer to her bosom until finally I suffocated. I lay on her bosom breathless for a time uncountable until one day, for a reason she has kept to herself, she took me out and stood me under a tree and I started to breathe again. I cast a sharp glance at her and said to myself, "So." Instantly, I grew my own bosoms, small mounds at first, leaving a small, soft place between them where, if ever necessary, I could rest my own head. Between my mother and me now were the tears I had cried, and I gathered up some stones and banked them in so that they formed a small pond. The water in the pond was thick and black and poisonous, so that only unnameable invertebrates could live in it. My mother and I now watched each other carefully, always making sure to shower the other with words and deeds of love and affection. I was sitting on my mother's bed, trying to get a good look at myself. It was a large bed, and it stood in the middle of a large, completely dark room. The room was completely dark because all the windows had been boarded up, and all the crevices stuffed with black cloth. My mother lit some candles, and the room burst into a pink-like, yellow-like glow. Looming over us, much larger than ourselves, were our shadows. We sat mesmerized, because our shadows had made a place between themselves, as if they were making room for someone else. Nothing filled up the space between them, and the shadow of my mother sighed. The shadow of my mother danced around the room to a tune that my own shadow sang, and then they stopped. All along, our shadows had grown thick and thin, long and short, had fallen at every angle, as if they were controlled by the light of day. Suddenly, my mother got up and blew out the candles, and our shadows vanished. I continued to sit on the bed, trying to get a good look at myself. My mother removed her clothes and covered thoroughly her skin with a thick, gold-colored oil, which had recently been rendered in a hot pan from the livers of reptiles with pouched throats. She grew plates of metal-colored scales on her back, and light, when it collided with this surface, would shatter and collapse into tiny points. Her teeth now arranged themselves into rows that reached all the way back to her long, white throat. She uncoiled her hair from her head, and then removed her hair altogether. Taking her head into her large palms, she flattened it, so that her eyes, which were by now ablaze, sat on top of her head and spun like two revolving balls. Then, making two lines on the soles of her feet, she divided her feet into crossroads. Silently, she had instructed me to follow her example. And now I, too, traveled along on my white underbelly, my tongue darting and flickering in the hot air. "Look," said my mother. My mother and I were standing on the seabed, side by side, my arms laced loosely around her waist, my head resting securely on her shoulder, as if I needed the support. To make sure she believed in my frailness, I sighed occasionally. Long, soft sighs, the kind of sighs she had long ago taught me could evoke sympathy. In fact, how I really felt was invincible. I was no longer a child, but I was not yet a woman. My skin had just blackened and cracked and fallen away, and my new impregnable carapace had taken full hold. My nose had flattened. My hair curled in and stood out straight from my head simultaneously. My many rows of teeth in their intractable trays were in place. My mother and I wordlessly made an arrangement. I sent out my beautiful sighs. She received them. I leaned ever more heavily on her for support. She offered her shoulder, which shortly grew to the size of a thick plank. A long time passed, at the end of which I had hoped to see my mother permanently cemented to the seabed. My mother reached out to pass a hand over my head, a pacifying gesture, but I laughed, and with great agility stepped aside. I let out a horrible roar, then a self-pitying whine. I had grown big, but my mother was bigger, and that would always be so. We walked to the Garden of Fruits, and there ate to our heart's satisfaction. We departed through the southwesterly gate, leaving, as always, in our trail, small colonies of worms. With my mother, I crossed unwillingly the valley. We saw a lamb grazing, and when it heard our footsteps, it paused and looked up at us. The lamb looked cross and miserable. I said to my mother, "The lamb is cross and miserable. So would I be, too, if I had to live in a climate not suited to my nature." My mother and I now entered the cave. It was the dark and cold cave. I felt something growing under my feet, and I bent down to eat it. I stayed that way for years, bent over, eating whatever I found growing under my feet. Eventually, I grew a special lens that would allow me to see in the darkest of darkness. Eventually, I grew a special coat that kept me warm in the coldest of coldness. One day, I saw my mother sitting on a rock. She said, "What a strange expression you have on your face, so cross, so miserable, as if you were living in a climate not suited to your nature." Laughing, she vanished. I dug a deep, deep hole. I built a beautiful house, a floorless house, over the deep, deep hole. I put in lattice windows, most favorite of windows by my mother, so perfect for looking out at people passing by without her being observed. I painted the house itself yellow, the windows green, colors I knew would please her. Standing just outside the door, I asked her to inspect the house. I said, "Take a look. Tell me if it's to your satisfaction." Laughing out of the corner of a mouth I could not see, she stepped inside. I stood just outside the door, listening carefully, hoping to hear her land with a thud at the bottom of the deep, deep hole. Instead, she walked up and down in every direction, even pounding her heel on the air. Coming outside to greet me, she said, "It is an excellent house. I would be honored to live in it," and then vanished. I filled up the hole and burnt the house to the ground. My mother has grown to an enormous height. I have grown grown to an enormous height also, but my mother's height is 3 times mine. Sometimes I cannot see from her breasts on up, so lost is she in the atmosphere. One day, seeing her sitting on the seashore, her hand reaching out in the deep to caress the belly of a striped fish as he swam through a place where 2 seas meet, I glowed, red with anger. For a while then I lived alone on the island, where there were 8 full moons, and I adorned the face of each moon with expressions I had seen on my mother's face. All the expressions favored me. I soon grew tired of living in this way and returned to my mother's side. I remained, though, glowing red with anger, and my mother and I built houses on opposite banks of the dead pond. The dead pond lay between us. In it, only small invertebrates with poisonous lances lived. My mother behaved toward them as if she had suddenly found herself in the same room with relatives we had long since risen above. I cherished their presence and gave them names. Still, I missed my mother's close company and cried constantly for her. But at the end of each day, when I saw her return to her house, incredible and great deeds in her wake, each of them singing loudly her praises, I glowed and glowed again, red with anger. Eventually, I wore myself out and sank into a deep, deep sleep, the only dreamless sleep I have ever had. One day, my mother packed my things in a grip and, taking me by the hand, walked me to the jetty. Placed me on board a boat in care of the captain. My mother, while caressing my chin and cheeks, said some words of comfort to me because we had never been apart before. She kissed me on the forehead and turned and walked away. I cried so much my chest heaved up and down. My whole body shook at the sight of her back turned toward me as if I had never seen her back turned toward me before. I started to make plans to get off the boat, but when I saw that the boat was encased in a large green bottle, as if it were about to decorate a mantelpiece, I fell asleep until I reached my destination, the new island. When the boat stopped, I got off, and I saw a woman with feet exactly like mine, especially around the arch of the instep. Even though the face was completely different from what I was used to, I recognized this woman as my mother. We greeted each other at first with great caution and politeness, but as we walked along, our steps became one, and as we talked, our voices became one voice, and we were in complete union in every other way. What peace came over me then, for I could not see where she left off and I began, or where I left off and she began. My mother and I walked through the rooms of her house. Every crack in the floor holds a significant event. Here, an apparently healthy young man suddenly dropped dead. Here, a young woman defied her father, and while riding her bicycle to the forbidden lover's meeting place, fell down a precipice, remaining a cripple for the rest of a very long life. My mother and I find this a beautiful house. The rooms are large and empty, opening on to each other, waiting for people and things to fill them up. Our white muslin skirts billow up around our ankles. Our hair hangs straight down our backs as our arms hang straight at our sides. I fit perfectly in the crook of my mother's arm, on the curve of her back, in the hollow of her stomach. We eat from the same bowl, drink from the same cup. When we sleep, our heads rest on the same pillow. As we walk through the rooms, we merge and separate, merge and separate. Soon we shall enter the final stage of our evolution. The fishermen are coming in from the sea. Their catch is bountiful. My mother has seen to that. As the waves plop, plop against each other, the fishermen are happy that the sea is calm. My mother points out the fishermen to me. Their contentment is a source of my contentment. I am sitting in my mother's enormous lap. Sometimes I sit on a mat she has made for me from her hair. The lime trees are weighed down with limes. I have already perfumed myself with their blossoms. A hummingbird has nested on my stomach, a sign of my fertileness. My mother and I live in a bower made from flowers whose petals are imperishable. There is the silvery blue of the sea, crisscrossed with sharp darts of light. There is the warm rain falling on the clumps of castor bush. There is the small lamb bounding across the pasture. There is the soft ground welcoming the soles of my pink feet. It is in this way my mother and I have lived for a long time now.
Laureen Towler read Jamaica Kincaid's My Mother. From Jamaica Kincaid, we turn to Charles Johnson and a story from his collection Soul Catcher and Other Stories. A soldier for the crown imagines the situation of slaves at the time of the American Revolution. The reader is the actor and director, Reuben Santiago Hudson.
You always were a gambler. Before the war broke out, when you were still a servant in Master William Selby's house, you'd bet on anything. How early spring thaw might come, or if your older brother Titus would beat your cousin Caesar in a wrestling match. And most of the time, you won. There was something about gambling that you could not resist. There was suspense, the feeling that the future was not already written by white hands or finished. There was chance, the luck of the draw. In the roll of a dice or a card game, there was always, what to call it, an openness. A chance that the outcome would go this way or that, for or against you. Of course, in bondage to Master Selby, there were no odds. Whichever way the dice fell or the cards came up, you began and ended your day a slave. But did you win this time? Standing by the wooden rail on a ship bound for Nova Scotia, crammed with strangers fleeing the collapse of their colonial world, women and children, whites and blacks, whose names appear in Brigadier General Samuel Birch's Book of Negroes, you pull a long shanked pipe from your red-tinted coat, pack the bowl with tobacco, and strike a friction match against a nail in your boot heel. You know you are fortunate to be on board. Now that the Continental Army is victorious, blacks who fought for the crown are struggling desperately to leave on His Majesty's ships departing from New York Harbor. Even as your boat eased away from the harbor, some leaped from the docks into the water, swimming toward the ship for this last chance to escape slavery. Seeing them, you'd thought, that might have been me. But it wasn't. You've always been lucky that way, at taking risks, running away from bondage, taking on new identities. Yet you wonder what to call yourself now, a loyalist, a traitor, a man without a country? As the harbor shrinks, growing fainter in the distance, severing you forever from this strange, newly formed nation called the United States, you haven't the slightest idea, after years of war, which of these names fits or what the future holds. Though on one matter you are clear. From the start, you were fighting for no one but yourself. The day after Lieutenant General Sir Henry Clinton promised liberty to all blacks deserting the rebel standard and willing to fight on the side of the British, you learned that Titus and Caesar were planning to flee. In the evening, on your way to the quarters, after finishing your duties in the house, Titus stopped you outside the barn and he asked, "Can you go back to the kitchen and sneak out some provisions for us?" Naturally, you had asked him, "What for?" And he put his fingers to his lips, shushing you. "See, they plan to steal two horses," he said, "then ride to safety behind British lines." "You're leaving?" You were almost speechless with anger. "And you're not taking me?" "How can I?" he asked. "You're only 15. "What that got to do with anything? I can fight." "You ever fired a gun?" "No, but I can learn." "Well, once I'm free and got the papers to prove it, I'll come back. Titus, if you don't take me, I'll tell." And for a heartbeat or two, Titus looked as if he might hit you. And grudgingly, he agreed to bring you along, despite your age and his declaration after your parents' deaths that he'd keep you from harm. You did as he requested, returning to the house and filling a sack with food, Master Selby's clothing, even some of the mistress's jewelry that the three of you might barter, and then delivered all this to your brother and Caesar in the barn. The three of you left that night on two of the master's best horses, you riding behind Titus, your arms tightly circling his waist until you stopped to make camp in the woods. There, Caesar suggested that it would help if you all changed your names and appearances as much as possible, since Master Selby was sure to post your descriptions. Titus said fine. He'd grow a beard and call himself John Free. Caesar liked that and said, then I'll be George Liberty. They waited for you to pick a name, poking sticks at the campfire, sending up sparks into the starless sky. Give me time, you said, changing into buckskin breeches and blue stockings and a checkered woolen shirt. I shave my hair off, and I'll think of something before we get there. I don't want to rush. What you didn't tell them that night was how thrilling, how sweet this business of renaming oneself felt, and that you wanted to toy with 1,000 possibilities, each name promising a new nature, turning them over on your tongue and creating whole histories for each before settling, as you finally did, on Alexander Freeman as your new identity. Thus it was, Alexander Freeman, George Liberty, and John Free, who rode a few days later, bone-weary from travel, into the British camp. You will never forget this sight. Scores of black men in British uniforms with the inscription, Liberty to Slaves, on their breasts, bearing arms so naturally one would have thought they were born with a rifle in their hands. Some were cleaning their weapons, others marched. Still others were relaxing or stabbing their bayonets at sacks suspended from trees or performing any of the 1,000 chores that kept a regiment well-oiled and ready. When you signed on, the black soldier who wrote down your names didn't question you, though he remarked he thought you didn't look very strong. The three of you were put immediately to work, harder work, you recall, than anything you'd known working in Master Selby's house. But for the first time in 15 years, you fell to each task eagerly, gambling that the labor purchased a new lease on life. Over the first months, then years, of the seesawing war, you, Titus, and Caesar served His Majesty's army in more capacities than you had fingers on the hand, as orderlies to the white officers, laborers, cooks, foragers, and as foot soldiers who descended upon farms abandoned by their white owners, burning the enemy's fortifications and plundering plantations for much-needed provisions, as spies slipping in and out of southern towns to gather information, and as caretakers to the dying when smallpox swept through your regiment, weakening and killing hundreds of men, your brother among them. And it was then you nearly gave up the gamble. You wondered if it might not be best to take your chips off the table and pray the promise of the Virginia Convention that black runaways to the British side would be pardoned was genuine, and slink back home, your hat in your hand, to Master Selby's farm, if it was still there. Or perhaps you and Caesar might switch sides, deserting to the ranks of General Washington, who, pressured for manpower, belatedly reversed his opposition to Negroes fighting in the Continental Army. And then there was that magnificent declaration penned by Jefferson, proclaiming that we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Words you'd memorized after hearing them. If the Continentals won, would this brave new republic be so bad? Alex, those just words, said Caesar. White folks' words for other white folks. But without us, the rebels would lose. So would the redcoats. Both sides need us. But I don't trust neither one to play fair when this thing is over. They can do that declaration over. No, the words I want to see are on the British pass with my name on it. I'm staying put until I see that. Caesar never did. A month later, your regiment was routed by the Continental Army. The rebels fired cannons for 6 hours, shelling the village your side occupied 2 days before. You found pieces of your cousin strewn everywhere, and you ran. You lived by your wits in the countryside, stealing what you needed to survive until you reached territory still in British hands, and again found yourself a pawn in the middle of other men's battles. Camden, where your side scattered poorly trained regulars led by General Gates, then liberated slaves who donned their master's fancy clothing and powdered wigs and followed along behind Gates as his men pressed on. And the disastrous encounter at Guilford Courthouse, where 600 redcoats died, and Cornwallis was forced to fall back to Wilmington for supplies, then later abandoned North Carolina altogether, moving on to Virginia. During your time as a soldier, you saw thousands sacrifice their lives. And no, it wasn't as if you came through with only a scratch. At Camden, you took a ball in your right shoulder. Fragments remain there still, making it a little hard for you to sleep on that side or withstand the dull ache in your shoulder on days when the weather is damp. But, miraculously, as the war began to wind down, you were given the elusive, long-coveted British Pass. On the ship now traveling north past Augusta, you knock your cold pipe against the railing, shaking dottle from its bowl, then reach into your coat for the scrap of paper that was so difficult to earn. Behind you, other refugees are bedding down for the night, covering themselves and their children with blankets. You wait until one of the hands on deck passes a few feet beyond where you stand. Then you unfold the paper, with fingers stiffened by the cold. In the yellowish glow of the ship's lantern, tracing the words with your forefinger, shaping your lips silently to form each syllable, you read, "This is to certify to whosoever it may concern that the bearer hereof, Alexander Freeman, a Negro, resorted to the British lines in consequence of the proclamations of Sir William Howe and Sir Henry Clinton, late commanders-in-chief in America, and that the said Negro has hereby His Excellency Sir Benjamin Hampton's permission to go to Nova Scotia, or wherever else he may think proper, by order of Brigadier General Rutledge." The document, dated April 1783, brings a broad smile to your lips. Once your ship lands and you find a home, you will frame this precious deed of manumission. At least in this sense, your gamble paid off. And for now, you still prefer the adopted name, Alexander Freeman, to the one given you at birth, Dorothy. Maybe you'll be Dorothy again, later in Nova Scotia. Of course, you'll keep the surname Freeman, and Lord willing, when it's safe, you will let your hair grow out again to its full length, wear dresses, and perhaps start a new family to replace the loved ones that you lost during the war.
A Soldier for the Crown by Charles Johnson, read by Reuben Santiago Hudson. Selected Shorts is produced by Catherine Minton and directed by Isaiah Sheffer. The executive director of Symphony Space is Cynthia Elliott. Our radio producer is Sarah Montague, and our production assistant is Miranda Schaefer. The readings are recorded by Miles B. Smith, and our mix engineer is Stu Kennedy. Major support for Selected Shorts is provided by Houghton Mifflin, publishers of the Best American Short Stories, edited in 2009 by Alice Siebold. Additional support is provided by the Dungannon Foundation, sponsor of the Ray Award for the Short Story, the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art, New York State Council on the Arts, a state agency, the Henry Nias Foundation, Lila Acheson Wallace Theater Fund of the New York Community Trust, and Warren and Jane Weiss and the Applebaum Foundation. Selected Shorts is a co-production of Symphony Space and WNYC Radio in New York and is distributed nationwide by PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Hi, I'm Isaiah Sheffer. Greetings to our Selected Shorts podcast audience. If you've always wanted to be a selector of shorts yourself, here's your chance. On June 9, 2010, Selected Shorts at Symphony Space in New York will feature published stories selected by you, our audience nationwide. Go to selectedshorts.org/favorite to submit your story suggestions. Then, in the spring, you'll vote for your favorite of the final contenders.